Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Ann Martha Deal, and Jason Croft at the controls this morning. By the way, we'd like to thank everyone who helped us meet our goal during our winter membership campaign. 873 listeners contributed a total of $100,341.50 to WILL Radio during the past week. We'd also like to welcome 183 new members to the Friends of WILL. Your pledges of support will help us fulfill our pledge to provide you with the best possible programs and services in the coming year. And we want to say thank you very much. In this part of the program, we'll be looking for your health questions. This is something that we do every other month. Of course, throughout the year, we do a number of shows about health. We have physicians here who are on the program on a fairly regular basis. We have a pediatrician. We have an OBGYN who are here every month. Occasionally, we have various specialists on the program. But we thought it would be a good idea sometime back. We thought it would be a good idea to have someone who was more of a generalist on the program a little bit more often, to take a variety of questions, and that is what we're doing here this morning. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He sees people of all ages in his practice, people with a variety of complaints and health concerns. And when we are here on this program, we just sort of title it Talk to the Family Doctor. So making it as wide open as possible. If you have questions about your health, can be for yourself, can be for your children, whoever it is that's in your life that you're concerned about, you can call in. And I know that the doctor will do his best to help you out. I do try to caution people again when we do these programs that we can't do diagnosis over the phone. There are some limits as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But we also hope that we can add to your health knowledge by doing these shows. It's a place to start. You can ask some basic questions, get some basic information. And then, of course, if you have concerns, you need to pursue that with someone who can see you. But this is a place that you can start. And if you have a kind of a general health question, give us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and those are the numbers. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
And is there anything, I sometimes try to arm myself with things that are new and interesting that I could ask you about, and I don't really have anything in particular. Is there anything that you have seen lately that is sort of noteworthy or you would want to mention just kind of off the top of your head?
One new recent change in recommendations for children has come out, and that's a now blanket recommendation for hepatitis A immunization. This has actually not been a very common problem in our immediate geographic area, but has been a problem in other parts of the country. In those areas, they found that routine immunization did indeed lower the risk of hepatitis A, which generally speaking is a self-limited illness, but is something that can be fairly contagious, so it can sort of travel through the population relatively quickly. The recommendation was to try and minimize the chance of it spreading through the rest of the population. Most of the recommendations for immunizations that come out medically are often then followed a few years later by the school systems then requiring those immunizations for entrance into school. So we might just alert our families with younger children that they may want to talk to their family physician or pediatrician about this particular recommendation for immunization. It is not required for school in Illinois at this time.
All right. Well, we have a caller to start us off, someone on a cell phone. Let's talk with them on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I had a question. My 15-year-old daughter was diagnosed with being unwell from an Epstein-Barr virus. and we're going to need to repeat her her blood tests to make sure her liver enzymes are no longer elevated. Do we need to be concerned long-term because she's had this infection or not?
Epstein-Barr virus is most commonly associated with the illness mononucleosis. The illness itself is not uncommonly associated with some irritation or inflammation to the liver, which can be picked up on standard laboratory testing of the liver. In the vast majority of cases, once the infection has sort of run its course, as most viral infections do, the irritation and inflammation to the liver subsides, and you should see within generally no more than a six-week period a significant decline back toward normal of those elevated liver function tests. To our knowledge, there isn't any long-term complications associated with this, assuming that the liver enzymes do indeed go back to normal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you for the call. And indeed, other people who are listening, if you have questions, like to talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl Clinic in Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There was something here that I came across that was kind of interesting that I'd heard about recently and I thought I might ask you about. This was a study looking at the an over-the-counter available thing called saw palmetto that some people believe can help with enlarged prostate, with benign enlarged prostate. It's one of those things that, man, if you live long enough, chances are you're going to have this problem. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have cancer. Some of the symptoms can be sort of annoying, like having to go to the bathroom a lot. But other than that, it's not a life-threatening kind of problem.
Right.
And some people have taken this saw palmetto to try to help as an alternative to prescription medications that are available. And a study has been done that apparently shows that it works no better than placebo. And I guess I think one of the interesting things about this was that the guys who were taking the saw palmetto reported, and I guess it was based on self-report of their symptoms, reported a little bit of improvement. But also the guys who were taking the placebo also reported a little bit of improvement, which goes to that idea that says, if your doctor gives you something, you think it's going to help.
It probably will.
So maybe that's another, we could talk about placebo. But you want to talk just a little bit about saw palmetto?
The studies with any type of herbal supplement are somewhat limited in the sense that you can buy different herbal supplements at different stores and end up actually getting different compounds. There isn't any standardization. So one of the questions always comes up is, well, what did I really take? How much of it was I taking? And did I get any benefit from it? In large-scale studies, you have to standardize the compound that you're giving everybody, and the commercially available substances are not standardized, and that's one of the criticisms of supplements is that they don't meet the same regulatory standards as FDA-approved drugs. But the other part is, just as you mentioned, is in all comparison drug studies, there are people who, when they get the, quote, sugar pill, report improvement. Those same people sometimes also report terrible side effects. So there is a proportion of patients who just simply thinking that they're taking a medication will feel better. And also there are those who will actually think that they're being harmed by it when in fact they're being given an inert substance. And that background has to be subtracted from the results of the study against which the active compound is being compared. Because basically, if the placebo gives you 30% improvement and your drug gives you 30% improvement, you're probably not actively working with something that's useful. Mm-hmm. Now, if your placebo gave you a 30% response, but your active medication gave you a 75% response, well, then there's probably something there. But again, you have to compare sort of apples to apples. You have to have the same set of patients with the same characteristics. And ideally, the only thing being different is the substance under study. But that's an ideal situation, and many studies aren't ideal. And in this particular case, salt palmetto was thought to potentially be helpful. But as you point out in this most recent study, the more carefully you do the studies, the more questionable the results come. And I would have to say that that's probably true for a fair number of herbal supplements, is that they're just very, very difficult to test accurately and figure out if indeed they do what they claim to do.
Yeah. So in this particular study, you would have to assume that the people who are compounding the saw palmetto that they were giving their patients would be careful to make sure that it was that the dosage was controlled, that it was that indeed the active ingredient was there.
Correct.
And so that would suggest that it seems that it's not particularly beneficial.
At this point, it probably falls into the category of it's not probably going to do anybody harm.
Yeah.
There aren't any particularly bad side effects related to taking it. But again, in many instances where there isn't much downside to trying it, telling patients that they can go ahead and give it a try for a few months and see if it makes a difference to them, I don't think is unreasonable. Regardless of why they feel better, if they feel better, that's fine. On the other hand, if it doesn't really make any difference, then there's probably little point in continuing to take it.
Yeah. Well, there are prescription medications that are intended to treat the same symptoms.
Yes.
Right.
There are both prescription medications and surgical procedures designed to address the symptoms associated with what's referred to commonly as BPH, which is benign prostatic hyperplasia, or the normal age-related enlargement of the prostate gland that men get just over time.
Mm-hmm. What are your recommendations about now? For men, there is a blood test that you can do
called the PSA.
A PSA that will give you some reading on prostate health. It doesn't tell you everything, because if you get one of these and the reading is high, then you have to ask, why is it?
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean that you have prostate cancer, but it would give you a reason to look more closely. Right. Is there now sort of a standard recommendation about who should have it and how often the test should be done?
Well, this is still a fairly controversial area, because the PSA, which stands for prostate-specific antigen, is not a particularly good test for prostate cancer screening. But the problem is we don't have any other test to take its place. And that's really where the research is going on right now, is can we find a better test, something that is more specific for prostate cancer? Right now, the PSA can indeed be elevated abnormally by a wide variety of conditions that affect the prostate other than cancer. Cancer is in the list of things that can potentially raise it. And so if you get the test done, it comes back elevated, you're exactly right. You have to go through the process of sorting out, well, why is it elevated? And it can be elevated for just age and size of the prostate. A prostate infection can raise it. Cancer can also raise it. In many instances, if this is a persistent elevation without obvious explanation, then a prostate biopsy is going to end up being done. This is an outpatient procedure, but not necessarily something that would be fun to do. And consequently, with the PSA, there are a fair number of prostate biopsies that are done that don't show cancer, which is a good thing. But if we had a better test for screening, we could probably sort out those people who have an elevated PSA for non-cancerous reasons versus those who do, and try and limit our biopsies to those who are more likely to have cancer. So currently we have this discussion with patients, and we ask them, have you had prostate problems? Is there a family history of prostate cancer? If so, this is the only test we have. Maybe it's a good thing to check. What is being looked at right now is a concept referred to as PSA velocity, which is a tracking of your PSA results over time. There's a normal range, and if there is a sudden acceleration, your test results for the last 5 years have always been 1, and now all of a sudden it's 4, but 4 is still in the normal range, but this is a big jump for you, that's supposed to potentially be a little clue that something metabolically is going on in your prostate and maybe needs to be looked at a little sooner. So the value of a single number may not be all that reliable, but your numbers over time may indeed turn out to be a potential indicator, and there are studies going on right now to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. We have someone on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a few comments. I'm really glad you just gave the discussion that you did about fallibility of tests. I'm trained as a statistician, and I was just going to mention the fact that in a lot of medical studies or behavioral studies or things like that, the effect size, meaning how much an actual valid treatment helps you, may actually be fairly small. I mean, this is the same thing with a lot of the epidemiological studies where people are talking about things like relative risk. The actual effect might not be that big. That doesn't mean it isn't important, especially if you chain together a whole bunch of them, which is why, you know, smoking heavily, drinking heavily, et cetera, are going to cause you trouble. But in the case of some of these studies, it's not at all uncommon that you run a whole bunch of studies on something that has relatively modest effect sizes, and a fair number of them come out not statistically significant. I've actually seen, there's a classic case study that's used in statistics education, which are the statistics from a bunch of beta blocker studies, and beta blockers certainly, you know, help people, but if you actually just counted how many studies didn't show statistical significance, it's pretty substantial. So I don't know if you have any comments.
Well, I think one of the comments that I would make is that folks frequently will read in a newspaper article or a magazine article that some new treatment or medication, you know, has a 50%, you know, improvement over previous, or the risk of some particular disease is 50% higher if, you know, X is present. And what I end up having to talk with folks about is, you know, if, let's say the incidence of a particular disease is 2%, and,
right,
and some factor comes along and raises that to 4%, well, you just doubled your risk of that particular problem, but you still have a 96 out of 100 chance of not having it at all. And,
yeah.
And yet if the study says, you know, you're at 100% higher risk if you have X, you know, it's a little misleading, you know, if the baseline is 2% and now it's 4%.
Yeah, that's right. And I've noticed just reading a lot of studies in the newspaper that unfortunately there seems to be two big biases. One is the one you just mentioned, and the other one is what I'll, for lack of a better word, call deterministic thinking. And I, short of sitting down on a piece of paper, I can't tell what the overlap between some two distributions is, you know, because there's always variation in any population.
Sure.
Would be with something like a 20% effect size, which is not a trivial one, but it's pretty substantial. There's still going to be a lot of people in the treatment group, even if the treatment's working, that get worse,
mm-hmm,
or have no effect at all, and there'll be people in the other group that don't. And unfortunately, a lot of times, it's sort of a well-known bias of people to dramatically understate the within group variation. So I was very pleased that you were discussing the fact that this test has kind of not very good performance, but there are ways you can get more out of it, and also the fact that there's costs to false positives, which I think a lot of people often tend to neglect. So thanks a lot.
You're very welcome, sir.
Well, I think that really, that's one of the points, and you made the point, and I think it's interesting when you talk about some of the controversy surrounding the PSA, and that is some people are saying, well, say for sake of argument that we've decided we want to start screening, and we'll do annual screening for all men over 50. But then the question is, okay, well, you get back all this data, what are you going to do with that? And I guess a particular concern is, as the caller suggests, is the possibility that a test will come back and it will say to you, we think there's got a problem. We think we have a problem here. So then you go, you say, okay, we have to do further investigations. And I guess you probably don't want to do a biopsy unless you have a really good reason to do it. So I think that was maybe one of the concerns that, for example, would we end up doing biopsies that probably we don't need to because we have an elevated PSA?
And the answer to your question is yes, undoubtedly. But the problem that we have right now is that we don't have a better test than what we have right now. Mm-hmm. And as such, we're simply stuck with this is where we're at. Now, as the medical science progresses, we get a better test, ideally. Ideally, the perfect test would separate out those people who have the disease from those who don't. But as our previous caller mentioned, all tests, regardless of what kind, have a sort of falsely positive, comes back abnormal, but the person's fine, or falsely negative.
Comes back, says the person's fine, and they're not.
Exactly. And what you would want in terms of a screening test is to have your false positives and your false negatives to be as low as possible. But there are no tests where those numbers are both zero. Mm-hmm. And that's just the nature of life as it stands right now. And a fair amount of the data, as you mentioned, that's being gathered with large-scale populations is then used to try and sort out. You know, maybe we don't need to screen 50-year-olds. Maybe it's 60-year-olds that we should be looking at because there isn't enough incidence of disease before then to warrant wide or mass-scale screening. But these things sort of evolve over time as information becomes available. One of the comments that I have with my sort of menopausal patients is the whole concept of using estrogen replacement was a giant experiment. And not all experiments are successful. But if you go back historically and look at, say, heart disease, there was a very definite observation that said, gee, premenopausal women don't have a very high incidence of heart disease. Mm-hmm. Postmenopausal women have a much higher incidence of heart disease. Well, what's the obvious difference between these two? Well, it must be the estrogen that they lose when they go through menopause. So the idea was, we'll give them back the estrogen. And it wasn't until years and years later that they got enough data on enough people to be able to say, you know, that really didn't seem to work out all that well. And so the previous recommendations of, gee, everybody ought to be on estrogen replacement because it's good for your heart now is, well, maybe not. And we got to sit down and talk to people about what are their risks of heart disease. We definitely found out that putting that replacement estrogen back in the system increased the risk of breast cancer. It did some other positive things. It reduces the risk of osteoporosis, but these are, all have to be balanced then with a given individual. But from a historical perspective, you know, thousands of years ago, you didn't have to worry about menopause. Nobody lived that long. So this is, from a historical perspective, a relatively new problem as to what to do about menopause. And the answer is nobody's sure yet. But the use of estrogen was part of an experiment to find out, would that be a good thing or not? And many, many things that are currently recommended are indeed part of a, in essence, a large-scale experiment to find out what happens. The statin medications for lowering cholesterol seem to lower cholesterol dramatically, also seem to be associated with a reduced risk of heart disease because of that, but nobody's been on them for 50 years. So the question becomes, well, what happens if you take a statin for 50 years? And the answer is nobody knows. We know that what your risk of heart disease is, at least in the United States, is still the number one cause of death for folks over 40. So you might in the short run say, well, I want to lower my cardiovascular risk and I'll worry about what the long-term risk of, you know, one of the statin medications is later. But maybe we'll find out in 30 years that, you know, statins cause some other problem. But we don't know that yet. And that's just where we're at.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have a question, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here in Indiana on our toll-free line. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Two things. One, if you can say anything at all, is the growing companies that will offer tests. You just come in and whammy. You go out, and I imagine they give you a sheet of something that says this and that and that and this. A lot of that comes out of the Chicago area. I listen on the radio stations up there, and every once in a while something will show up in my small town where I am at a mall to you know, check your heart and a bunch of other things for $180, $200, $250, whatever. Two questions about that is, can you say anything about reliability, reputation, or anything like that? And secondly, would a doctor, would your own doctor pay any attention to the test you might bring to him that you got at one of these places?
I'm not sure I know exactly what kind of test you're referring to.
Well, most of them, usually when they're advertising, they're talking about they come in, you find out how much plaque you have. So I presume they must be doing some, you know, I don't know if it's sonic test or what, on your arteries and heart and stuff like that, the upper respiratory area and stuff. And they have a different pay scale. They advertise a lot on the Chicago radio stations. And I just wondering about them, you know, whether or not the test, which may be okay, whether or not, you know, a doctor would even pay attention to it, would maybe want to send you to a place he's had experience with to do testing, you know, like the hospital lab or whatever.
Right. In terms of the organization doing the testing, if you don't have any idea of how reputable or reliable they are, then you're going to have to, you know, take the results with sort of a cautious attitude, as opposed to, you know, a facility that you're very familiar with how things are done. So it probably wouldn't be uncommon for a physician where a patient brings in a test that raises some question to simply say, okay, well, we need to check this out a little further, and either repeat that or do the next test that follows the initial one. In this particular case, sonogram type tests are indeed done to check for vascular obstructions. Those are typically looked for in the neck with your carotid arteries, because those are areas where plaque can develop that can cause strokes. And they're also looking usually in the lower extremities for evidence of blockage indicating peripheral vascular disease. And this is more common, again, in folks who have other risk factors for vascular disease, like high blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes and smoking. But I'm not currently aware of any blanket recommendation that says, gee, everybody ought to go out once a year and, you know, get all their blood vessels checked. The problem that we have with sort of mass screening with any kind of test is you're going to get back on a certain number of people test results that are technically not normal, but don't necessarily mean disease. And those people are going to end up going through a whole lot of other testing to prove that. This has been looked at in situations where one of the other tests that you didn't quite mention, but that has been done, are CT scans, where people have actually had, you know, well, just sort of CT my whole body and find out what happens. And there are a fair number of what we consider incidental findings, but they then generate a whole lot of concern and question on the part of the patient, and then subsequently generate more tests to try and prove that what was seen wasn't really a problem. So in most instances, tests should be done in situations where there's enough pre-existing risk to justify doing the test. Patients should have risk factors for what you're looking for. Just to sort of blanketly look for problems on everybody in the absence of symptoms or signs is not cost effective. and generally speaking, is going to end up raising more questions than it answers.
Second question, David, or not?
Yeah, sure.
Second question, which it's more at home. I sort of was met at the door of my doctor's office, and she says, guess what? I said, what? She says, cholesterol levels are going down to 70 now. The 100 is passe. And there wasn't much explanation about it or anything. You know, it's, you know, take your blood and we'll let you know later on what's going on. I was wondering if you know anything about that and why that has happened. Is it more data's come in for a longer period of time or something like that?
Well, what you're referring to in terms of that particular number is somebody's LDL, which is their bad cholesterol. The most recent data has suggested that people who have cardiovascular disease or significant risk factors for cardiovascular disease like diabetes are probably best served by getting their LDL 70 or less. A perfectly otherwise healthy adult with no cardiovascular disease, there isn't any current recommendation to try and push their LDL to 70 or below, because if there were, everybody in the country would be on medication, because those levels are difficult to obtain without medication. But in high-risk individuals, the most recent data does indeed show lower cardiovascular risk for those who can get their LDL 70 or less.
All right. Let's talk again with another caller here. And this is someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have what I think is kind of a strange question. And my fingernails on the left hand only, not the thumb, just the fingernails, don't seem to want to grow. And it's been going on for a couple of months, actually probably since fall. And they kind of chip off. And I don't know what's causing it. They're okay on the right hand. I wear rubber gloves when I'm washing dishes. So, I mean, both hands are kind of equally in soapy water if they're going to be in soapy water. You got any ideas at all?
No trauma to the fingers on the left hand?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, trauma meaning didn't catch them in the car door or
right,
anything like that.
Right.
No, it's just the fingers. It's not the thumb.
Anything with your toenails?
No.
You have me stumped.
Well, I have me stumped, too. So I'm thinking maybe if they don't start growing before long. I do know that my fingernails and my hair grow in, like I will call, yearly cycles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe they'll decide now to start growing. I don't know.
But I don't have any explanation for why the left would be different than the right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Thank you much.
All right, thank you. We'll go on here. Next is someone in St. Louis. Line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. This is Dr. Timothy Bailash. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist and not a regular listener, but heard your programs. I'm on the road here and wanted to commend your discussion about the interpretation of statistical data and laboratory tests. What I heard was very patient information, and it's a very complicated aspect of it that I think it's most people are aware that these are not black and white tests. But I wanted to offer a comment about the estrogen. There have been some revisions by different providers and researchers on that big study that came out in 2002. And in particular, when they looked at the data for estrogen replacement therapy, only in the women between 50 and 60 years old, they actually found that the event rates were improved when you took the estrogen progesterone therapy, that age seemed to make a difference in terms of how people responded to it. Saltpeter was the name of the person that published one of the papers in July of last year, I believe. I offer that to you, and there are some links on my website, which is dedicated to menopause and estrogen and progesterone therapies.
Well, I think you point out that in large-scale population studies that there are going to be subgroups that turn out to respond differently than the larger group. And part of the difficulty with interpreting the results of studies is trying to figure out which subgroup an individual patient might fit into as to whether or not they would or wouldn't benefit from a particular therapy. And I think your point is very well taken.
Exactly. And I would fault the media reporting of these things as tending to select out those things which seem dramatic at the time and to have very little retraction when something else comes into being. I mean, just last week there was apparently an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association about low-fat diets and its effect on heart disease out of the observational arm, I think, of that WHI study,
mm-hmm.
that there really isn't health benefits from a low-fat diet that people have been preaching. And so now you get into a credibility war, and who do you believe? So if I might, I would offer my website. It's easy to find. DrTimDelivers, I'm an obstetrician, .com. So DrTimDelivers.com. You can find it by DrTim, Dr. Tim, also, if you Google it. And there's quite a bit of information. It actually gets a little complicated. But it's a confusing issue, and I appreciate your taking the time to talk with your listeners about those statistical aspects. If I might make one comment about that also, one of the things that complicates these studies is that they are done over a period of time, and they're not true experiments, and that complicates the statistical interpretation, which also makes it difficult to assess them. So.
Because your subjects are changing over time.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Again, other questions are certainly welcome. We have about maybe 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. This is a program that we do every other month. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, deals with a wide range of people in his practice. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Going back a little ways, we are talking a little bit about prostate and prostate health.
Mm-hmm.
There apparently are some indications that there are things you can do to promote your prostate health and particularly perhaps lower your risk of prostate cancer that have to do with diet and nutrition. At least some things that seem to be helpful. Again, it may be one of these things that, well, maybe we're saying that now, but you know, who knows what we're going to be saying in another couple of years. Is there, let me put it this way, is there anything that a guy could do in terms of, you know, diet, health, lifestyle, those things that are easily within our, that do not involve taking a prescription medication that tend to promote prostate health?
The most commonly accepted piece of information right now is the beneficial role of a substance called lycopene, which is present in vegetables, in particularly large quantities in tomatoes. So if you like tomatoes, there's probably, again, no downside to including those in your diet. There are also some, quote, men's health vitamins mm-hmm. that include a little extra lycopene in there. And the question always comes up when things like this are recommended is there something about the natural substance when you ingest it in the form of tomato that's different, better or worse, than when you ingest the chemical lycopene in your vitamin? And the answer is nobody knows. Again, that's one of those things that is yet to be answered. In general, there isn't a heck of a lot that you can do one way or the other regarding your prostate. Probably the biggest risk factor for prostate cancer is having it in your family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if Grandpa had it and Dad had it and Uncle George had it, you probably ought to get checked pretty regularly. Not that we're going to be able to tell you what to do to prevent it, but ideally find it early enough that it is treatable and curable. Because prostate cancer is one of those cancers where if you find it early enough, it should indeed be curable. And until we find a better way to prevent it, our best chance is to try and find it early. And the current recommendations are for men, usually at age 50, to come in for an annual digital rectal examination. The physician will physically feel the prostate gland. And if after discussion you feel like the PSA is something that you want to have done, getting that drawn and tracking it over time along with that yearly exam is what's currently recommended. Now, if there's a strong family history of prostate cancer, we will usually recommend screening an individual 10 years before when it showed up in a family member. So, you know, if Dad had prostate cancer when he was 55, you know, you probably ought to think about starting no later than 45.
Hmm. Okay. Well, and we have time for other questions here. If you want to give us a call, again, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana.
Going along with the prostate, there have been some studies looking at medications given to individuals to see if indeed it would prevent prostate cancer. And this is one of those areas that came out with sort of a mixed bag, because what they found was they did have fewer prostate cancers, but the ones that they did have were more aggressive. So it was like, well, is that a good thing or not? So again, it's sort of a mixed picture. In some individuals, it may be worthwhile to talk to somebody about your family history and look at whether one of these medications might be worthwhile. But there currently aren't any blanket recommendations that, you know, all men ought to take X in order to prevent prostate cancer.
Yeah. All right. One of the things that occasionally this time of year we talk about are colds and flu. I'm just sort of curious. Doesn't seem that this season, as far as flu's concerned, influenza, true flu, that it's been particularly a bad year.
It
I don't know if anybody knows why that should. I guess you really never know in advance what it's going to be like.
Right. And I think there was plenty of vaccine this time around. And I think everybody who wanted to certainly was able to get a vaccine. And in that regard, I think that definitely helps, you know, prevent the spread of it. But no, it really has been kind of a mild winter from the influenza standpoint.
Are we, now I know that one can still get it. You can still get the flu in March. I know,
sure.
Because I got it 1 year in March.
Right.
Are we past or around the point where traditionally the numbers, historically the numbers of cases would have peaked?
Right.
By this point.
And should be declining.
We should be on the down slide.
That's great.
Of it.
Yeah. Okay. That's great.
So it seemed to me that one of the things I've seen recently is, and not maybe not just in connection with flu, but in connection with a lot of other disease, is the attempt to do a kind of an information campaign to alert people to the fact that common activities that we do spread germs. Things like, things just like coughing and sneezing. Mm-hmm. So it seems like now more and more we're trying to encourage people, kids particularly, to cover their mouths when they cough or they sneeze. Mm-hmm. But also just recently, I think I read something about how, and I don't remember specifically what this was, but the thrust of the article was that somebody is trying to discourage handshaking because they're saying, again, that, you know, that's a disease spreading thing.
Yes.
And as we have discussed, and probably other doctors have here on the program, one of the best things you can do to prevent the spread of disease is to wash your hands frequently.
The single most important thing that you can do is indeed wash your hands.
And I suppose there are actually also places around the world where people believe that there's enough problem with diseases so that sometimes people actually wear surgical masks. Mm-hmm. Out when they're out in the world, they wear surgical masks because they think that helps. Now, I'm not sure that really does, but maybe it does. Do you think that kind of thing actually, if we could get people to sort of do all of these things, do you think we might make a dent in infectious disease?
You would have to be very conscientious about it. But yes, in terms of some of the more readily contagious processes, it would definitely make a difference. But you'd have to, as you point out, get rid of handshaking. You'd have to get rid of money exchange. You would have to make sure that any other inanimate object that somebody else handled was clean before you handled it, or, you know, definitely make sure that you wash your hands again after handling it. Simply going down the stairs with your hand on the handrail would be a no-no, because there were 1,000 other people who went down that handrail before you with their hand all over it. Yeah. So to that extent, you know, you would have to be very, very conscientious about what you were coming in contact with and make a very deliberate effort to minimize that. It's not that it couldn't be done. It's just that there are many things that we sort of take for granted that we do all the time that, you know, it would be hard to remember that, gee, I just opened that door. Now I have to go wash my hands.
Yeah. It could get to be a little obsessive about that kind of thing.
Good.
How the common kinds of germs that would be likely to make us sick. For example, here we're sitting at a table that has some kind of, I don't know what the top is, formica or, you know, something sort of like that. On a surface like that, how long can germs live?
Days.
Oh, good.
Yeah. It was kind of interesting. They actually did a study where they went into an office, just, you know, where somebody worked, and they cultured a variety of surfaces from around the business. And it turned out that eating lunch at your desk was probably the worst place you could have picked to eat, because it was probably the surface that actually got cleaned the least. And in terms of bacterial counts, the toilet was actually the lowest, because somebody went in every single day and scrubbed it as part of the regular maintenance. So in terms of bacterial counts, it was actually the lowest thing in the office. And the desk surface was one of the higher ones.
Hmm. So take a little Windex and clean the top of your desk every day.
Yeah. I don't
know. Again, questions are welcome here. We have probably maybe 4 or 5 minutes. If somebody wants to call up here real quick, you will get the opportunity still to get in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The other thing I thought I might ask, again, this is something that has been in the news recently, has to do with cough syrup. Maybe you also saw some stories about this. And this, you know, at this time of year, people have coughs and colds. And so you go down to wherever it is, you buy your over-the-counter stuff. And there's all kinds of medicines available to treat various symptoms. Mm-hmm. And a big section of cough medicine. And it can be a really, really bad thing. I know, because over the past couple of years, I've had things where I've had coughs and I couldn't sleep.
Right.
You can't sleep, you're never going to get well. It's a bad deal. So you go and you hit the cough syrup. I think the thrust of this recent article, as I remember, was the cough syrup doesn't do anything.
And again, this is in sort of large-scale studies. Mm. Within that group, there are going to be indeed people who said, no, I don't think it made much difference. There are going to be people who said, hey, it made me worse. And there are going to be some people who say, yeah, it made me better. But if you take them all together, it probably didn't make a whole heck of a lot of difference. You're treating symptoms. If it makes you feel better, fine. If it doesn't make you feel any better, then don't take it. There's a certain amount of it just has to run its course and until it gets better. And if specifically you're looking at, you know, it's interrupting my sleep, a number of the nighttime cold preparations basically have enough other stuff in them, like alcohol and heavy-duty antihistamines, to simply put you to sleep. They may not be doing a thing for your cough, but they're sedating you enough that you sleep. So, but again, if that makes you feel better, that's fine.
Okay, so you would say with a cough medicine, for example, taken as directed, try it.
Right.
If it helps, good. If not,
forget it.
Sorry. Yeah. And take a couple of Benadryl and
go to sleep.
And go to sleep and hope, you know, hope for the best.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Champagne now, caller, line one. Hello.
I have a question. My son recently had a fracture in his foot that was difficult to diagnose with x-ray, so they did a bone scan, which seemed reasonable, and it clearly showed the fracture on the bone scan. But while they were doing his foot, they also did whole body scans. Why is that?
The test itself, once you put the material in to do the scan, basically goes everywhere in the body.
Right.
So there really isn't any additional exposure to recording the rest of the body. And in some instances, what they're doing, it'll vary by patient, but there are patterns of uptake on a bone scan that can be suggestive of things like bone tumors and metastatic disease, somebody who has cancer and it's spread to other places, or certain types of arthritic processes will also show up in other parts of the body. So having those other areas to compare to oftentimes allows them to exclude some of those other diagnoses from the list of things that they're concerned about, but they may or may not have applied to your son at all.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thanks very much for the call. We're kind of headed down here to our last few minutes. Is there anything in particular that you might like to mention to folks? In general sort of things, and generally sort of doctorly things that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think going back to our previous discussion about sort of the fallibility of tests, given that they have false positives and false negatives, and given the difficulty interpreting some studies, as the other physician pointed out, I think it's very, very important that people don't take just the headlines on a newspaper or magazine article and say, you know, oh my God, we're all going to die because they've now discovered this. But if there's a particular medical condition and or treatment that you have questions or concerns about, I don't think there's any substitute for sitting down with your own personal physician who knows you and ideally your family history, and trying to take all of the factors that are applicable and help you come to a conclusion and therefore a decision that you're comfortable with the understanding that there are very few right or wrong answers that are carved in stone, you know. But you do the best you can with the information that you have at hand at that particular time. And that's one of the reasons why you periodically need to go back, is to review what's new, what's different, what's changed. Is this still a good decision for me? And I think that's one of the primary benefits of having your own personal physician.
All right. Well, for now, we will say thanks to our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.